every day, billions of dollars change hands based on what is essentially, a collective hallucination.
Right, yeah, it really is
I mean,
just.
think about it. You tap this glowing green button on your phone, and instantly you own a tiny fraction of some massive tech giant located like 3,000 miles away. You
Exactly.
don't get a paper certificate in the mail.
Yeah.
You never meet the seller. You just blindly trust that it worked.
Yeah, you really do.
So today, we are opening up the hood of the most complex, highly engineered wealth machine in human history, the U.S. stock market.
And it is a really profound shift in perspective when you stop looking at the market as this, chaotic casino or a flashing ticker tape, and you start looking at it as the underlying plumbing of global
Oh,
capitalism.
plumbing, right.
Yeah, because we spend so much time agonizing over the daily noise, like which stock is up, which is down.
Oh, constantly.
Right, and we completely ignore the actual architecture making those trades possible in the first place.
And that architecture is exactly what we are tearing into for this deep dive.
Yes, we are.
We're working off a massive structural breakdown compiled today, June 17th, 2026. It pulls from extensive research across major financial media and institutional data, like the American newspaper and American TV.
Right. And I think it's important to say right off the bat, if you are tuning in for like short-term stock picks or some secret strategy to day trade tech stocks.
Yeah, this isn't for you.
No, exactly. We don't care what any specific company is trading at this morning. We are mapping out the actual operating system of the market itself.
The operating system. Okay, let's unpack this because the mission here is to totally demystify this machine for you, the listener.
Right. Whether you're a casual retail investor who just checks an app or a seasoned professional needing a structural refresher.
Exactly. We need to break down exactly how expectations about a company's future cash are miraculously converted into globally tradable claims.
Yeah, and the core thesis we're looking at frames the stock market as a three-layer machine.
Okay, what are the layers?
So first you have capital formation. That is for the issuers, the companies that actually need to raise money to build factories or hire engineers.
Makes sense.
Second, you have price discovery and liquidity. That's for you, the investor, figuring out what those shares are actually worth and being able to sell them when you want.
Right.
And third, you have policy transmission for the global financial system, because it's not just people buying and selling shares. It is literally the engine of the global economy.
And that engine requires a highly specific fuel to run, right? Like
Yeah.
the unmatched power of the U.S. equity market doesn't just spontaneously generate from American wealth.
No, it comes from a really unique cocktail.
Right.
You have massive scale, strictly enforceable disclosure laws, deep liquidity denominated in US dollars, and this is key, a culture that relentlessly converts narrative into valuation.
A culture that relentlessly turns narratives into valuation.
Yeah.
That is such a fascinating way to frame it.
It really is. And the rest of the world uses this architecture as their ultimate benchmark specifically because of that combination.
Okay, but to understand how this massive globally trusted machine processes those narratives today, we have to look at its bedrock.
Yeah, we have to go back.
Right? The underlying data traces this arc starting way back in 1792 with the Buttonwood Broker Clubs.
Oh, yeah.
Back then, it was just like personal networks of guys in top hats gathering under a literal tree.
Right, a literal buttonwood tree.
Yeah. And they were gathering to finance physical infrastructure like railroads, canals, banks.
It was entirely physical, highly localized, and based almost completely on personal reputation. Equity ownership was a private network back then.
So it's just an old boys' club.
Basically, yeah. But the critical pivot point that forced the system to evolve into what we have today was the crash of 1929.
Okay, let me stop you there because we hear about the 29 crash all the time. But structurally, what actually broke the machine?
Well, that disaster exposed the fatal flaws of a reputation-based system. It was rife with rampant manipulation, weak disclosure, and reckless leverage.
Wait, reckless leverage. How did people trade differently then compared to now?
So back then, you had retail investors buying stocks on massive margin. They were often putting down only 10% of the purchase price.
10%. Wow.
Yeah, and borrowing the rest. You also had these things called bucket shops.
What's a bucket shop?
They were essentially unregulated gambling parlors. They took bets on stock prices without ever actually executing trades on a real exchange.
That sounds incredibly shady.
Oh, it was. So when the market dipped, everyone was hit with margin calls simultaneously. They couldn't pay, so forced selling just cascaded.
Oh, man.
And because there were no standardized audited financials, nobody knew what any company was actually worth to step in and buy the dip. It was total free fall.
So out of the ashes of that free fall, we get the Securities Act of 1933 and the Exchange Act of 1934, basically the birth of the SEC.
Exactly.
How did that actually change the day-to-day operations, though?
It forced transparency. That was the moment the market shifted from a shadowy gentleman's club to a national disclosure and enforcement framework. Yeah. If a company wanted public money, it suddenly had to publish audited financial statements. Right. You couldn't just, you know, tell investors your railroad was doing great. You had to prove it with standardized math.
So they realized that for the machine to grow, it needed enforceable rules.
Precisely.
Okay, so fast forward through the decades. We get past the arrival of institutional pensions in the mid-century and the birth of electronic quoting with NASDAQ in the 70s.
Right, the digital shift.
And we arrive at today, this hyper-fragmented algorithmic era. It almost feels like a global property registry.
That's a good way to put it.
Like, people think they're trading pixels on a screen, but really, they are trading fractional claims on the future.
Yes.
And the only reason it works without collapsing into chaos is pure trust in the invisible plumbing underneath. I see terms like clearing, netting, and settlement systems thrown around all the time, like the NSCC and DTC.
Right, the real plumbing.
Yeah, but what is actually happening there? Like, what is netting in plain English?
Okay, think of netting like a massive group of friends buying rounds of drinks all night at a really crowded bar.
Okay, I'm with you.
If you try to settle every single drink individually, sending Venmo payments back and forth every 5 minutes.
That would be a nightmare.
Right. The system would clog and collapse. So netting just tallies up the massive web of transactions and settles the final score at the end of the night.
Oh, I see.
It takes trillions of dollars of chaotic, high-frequency trades and reduces them to a single daily settlement between brewers.
So millions of trades just get compressed down to a manageable transfer of funds.
Precisely. A trade isn't actually complete just because a buyer and a seller agree on a price.
Really?
No. Clearing organizations have to net the obligations. Settlement systems have to move the actual cash and the securities, and custodians have to record the ownership.
That is wild to think about.
Yeah. Investors only accept stomach-churning volatility on the surface because they fundamentally believe the property rights, the audits, and that unseen clearing process are completely rock solid.
Okay. So we have this bedrock of trust built on SEC laws from the 1930s and a massive netting system.
Yep.
But trust doesn't execute a trade. When I actually hit buy on my app, my order goes out into the ether. Where is it actually landing? Is it still going to some guy in a tailored jacket on Wall Street?
Not exactly. The U.S. equity market is a regulated network of different venues. We can break these down into four main archetypes.
Okay, hit me.
First, you have the New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE. This is the auction heritage, you know, the traditional symbol of blue chip public capitalism.
Right, the classic floor.
Exactly. It uses a hybrid model of designated market makers combined with modern electronics.
Now, I always hear about market makers, but what does that person, or I guess more accurately today, that algorithm actually do?
Well, a market maker's job is to ensure you can always buy or sell a stock the absolute second you want to. They are legally obligated to provide a two-sided quote.
Meaning they have to offer to buy and sell at the same time.
Exactly. They sit in the middle of the market, constantly offering to buy shares at a slightly lower price and sell them at a slightly higher price.
So they aren't betting on the direction of the company?
No, not at all. They are just collecting that tiny spread, the difference between the bid and the ask, millions of times a day.
Yeah.
That's their compensation for providing immediate liquidity.
Okay. That makes sense. And then you have NASDAQ, which has a totally different DNA, right?
Yeah, NASDAQ has an electronic dealer heritage. It's heavily associated with growth, technology, and innovation.
Right, the tech heavyweights. What's the third venue?
The third major one is Cboe. They operate multiple U.S. equities exchanges, but they are structurally central to the options and volatility ecosystem. You know, the VIX.
Right, the fear index.
Yeah, and they're a massive competitor in routing economics and selling market data.
Okay, and the fourth?
Finally, you have the OTC, or over-the-counter markets. These are broker-dealer quotation networks for securities that aren't listed on the major national exchanges.
Wait, hold on. Let's look at this from the listener's perspective for a second.
Okay.
Because tapping buy on a brokerage app feels completely identical whether you are buying a 100-year-old manufacturing giant on the NYSE or some speculative penny stock on the OTC market.
Yeah, it looks exactly the same.
Right. It's the exact same interface on your screen. So does the fact that a stock is listed on a prestige venue like the NYSE actually mean it's safer? Or is that just a branding illusion that obscures valuation risks for everyday investors?
That is a great point. Execution quality and structural risk vary wildly depending on the venue.
Wildly, huh?
Yes. The traditional blue chip prestige of the NYSE absolutely gives some investors a false sense of security regarding valuation.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, a terrible company with a dying business model can still hold a prestigious ticker symbol. The exchange guarantees a certain level of financial reporting and liquidity, not business success. And the data also highlights the massive strategic significance of the NYSE's closing auction. It processes billions of dollars in seconds and dictates exactly how global index funds rebalance their portfolios.
And on the flip side, the OTC markets carry severe structural risks, right?
Oh, yes. They are a necessary layer for securities that can't meet major listing standards, but they carry significantly higher dangers.
Like what?
We are talking about wide spreads, meaning you instantly lose money the second you buy, thin liquidity, meaning you might not be able to sell when you want to.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, plus weaker disclosures and, frankly, outright fraud. Tapping buy feels the same on your phone, but the safety net beneath you is entirely different.
That is such a crucial distinction. Okay, so venues are where the stocks live. But how do the trillions of dollars of passive capital out there actually know which stocks to buy on those venues?
Right, that's the next layer.
Let's talk about the rules that govern the money. The data frameworks refer to benchmarks as allocation machines. We're talking about indexes here.
Yes, and this is where the structural reality of the modern market really takes shape. Indexes are essentially just automated portfolio rules.
Automated rules?
Yeah, they dictate where passive capital flows without any human intervention. And the S&P 500 is the undisputed heavyweight here.
Right.
It's the large cap core that covers roughly 80% of available U.S. market capitalization. It's the default benchmark for global asset allocators.
And then you have the NASDAQ 100, which specifically isolates the 100 largest non-financial companies on the NASDAQ exchange.
Exactly.
Which naturally creates a massive bias toward tech, software, semiconductors, and long-duration growth.
Yeah, a huge bias. And then there's the Russell 2000, which is the small-cap segment.
Right.
This one is a crucial barometer for domestic cyclicality, labor costs, and sensitivity to interest rates, mainly because these smaller companies usually don't have global revenue streams to hide behind.
Got it. We also have to address the Dow Jones Industrial Average, though.
Oh, definitely.
Because modern structural analysis practically dismantles it. The report points out that the Dow is price-weighted. Why is that considered such a relic compared to the other indexes?
Because price weighting is fundamentally, well, mathematically flawed for a modern economy.
How so?
In the Dow, a stock's influence is based entirely on its per share price, not the actual total value of the company.
Wait, really?
Yes. So a $500 stock moving 1% impacts the Dow drastically more than a $50 stock moving 10%.
Even if the $50 stock represents a way bigger company.
Exactly. Even if it's 10 times larger in total market cap. It's a media-friendly cultural artifact, not a serious gauge of economic health.
Wow, I never realized that.
Yeah. The broader reality is that modern capital flows follow rules. If a company gets added to a major benchmark like the S&P 500, it receives a tidal wave of automatic passive buying. If it's removed, it suffers forced selling.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Let's follow that logic because I see a massive paradox here.
Okay, what is it?
If flows follow rules, and the S&P 500 is market cap weighted?
Yeah.
Aren't we just building a feedback loop?
I see where you're going.
Like if I buy an S&P 500 fund because I want to be sensible and diversified,
yeah.
I am actually systematically buying more of whatever stock has already gone up the most.
Yep.
The bigger a company gets, the larger its weight in the index, and the more of my monthly retirement contribution is forced into it.
Yeah.
Doesn't this mean passive investing is just a giant automated momentum machine?
What's fascinating here is that you've hit on the defining tension of modern indexing.
It seems so counterintuitive.
It is. Market capitalization weighting is highly efficient in one sense because it naturally reflects the aggregated wisdom of the market's pricing. But structurally, it inherently concentrates capital into massive winners.
Which explains why we are seeing mega cap tech stocks dominate the indexes so thoroughly right now.
Precisely. The passive investor believes they are buying broad, safe diversification across 500 companies. But the mathematical rules of the index are concentrating their risk heavily into a handful of giant companies at the very top.
Wow.
They are structurally forced to buy more of what is already the most expensive.
That is a wild loop to wrap my head around. So if passive money is just blindly following these index rules on autopilot, pouring cash into the biggest buckets,
yeah,
what are the actual active forces pulling the strings on the overall market's value?
Let's zoom out to the macroeconomic drivers for that.
Yeah, let's look at the major players pulling those levers.
To understand the forces, you really have to separate the actors by their primary incentives.
Okay.
First, you have retail investors, everyday people. They provide order flow, sentiment, and long-term capital. But historically, they're vulnerable to behavioral errors.
Sure.
Then you have institutions, the asset managers, sovereign wealth funds, and massive pensions. They are the whales. They actively set the allocation weights and influence corporate governance.
Yeah.
And lastly, you have the market makers we discussed earlier who don't care about the direction of the market at all. They just process the volume and collect the spreads.
But the real gravity, the ultimate force pulling on all of these actors, is the macro environment. The structural analysis highlights Federal Reserve policy and the 10-year Treasury yield as the valuation anchor of the market.
Yeah, the 10-year yield anchors everything because it represents the risk-free alternative to stocks.
How does that work?
Well, if you can get a guaranteed 5% return from the U.S. government, you are going to demand a significantly higher potential return to take a risk on a volatile tech stock.
That makes perfect sense. Mm. I always picture the Federal Reserve like the DJ at a massive nightclub.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. The public companies are the ones out there on the dance floor showing off their earnings reports, trying to look good for the investors.
Yeah.
But the Fed controls the tempo of the music. If the Fed cranks up the discount rate, if they make borrowing money more expensive, the music slows down. Everyone is forced to dance slower. And this hits growth stocks the hardest, right? Because their value is years in the future.
That analogy maps perfectly to the underlying mechanics, honestly. The tempo of that music alters two fundamental variables in finance.
Okay, what are they?
First, it changes the cash flow path, meaning the actual earnings a company is expected to make in the future. Second, it changes the discount rate.
And the discount rate is what, exactly?
It's simply the mathematical penalty applied to future earnings. If a tech company promises to make $1 billion 10 years from now, those future dollars are worth drastically less today if risk-free interest rates are high.
Right, because I could just put my money in a treasury bond right now instead.
Exactly. When the DJ changes the music, those two variables, cash flows and the discount rate, instantly compress into real-time prices on the exchange.
And right now, there's a new massive force violently reshaping that cash flow path. AI capital expenditure.
Oh, absolutely.
Artificial intelligence is rapidly expanding the long-term growth expectations for the entire market. But it's doing so by concentrating index risk heavily into very specific bottlenecks, like semiconductors, cloud platforms, and incredibly expensive power grid infrastructure.
It is a profound structural shift. And all this is happening within a broader global vacuum.
Yeah.
Consider the pipeline of global inflows.
Right.
Because of the dollar reserve system, global portfolios are heavily organized around treasury bonds as collateral. That capital flows into the legally enforceable SEC courts and disclosure systems we talked about,
right,
which then flows into our deep exchanges and finally into American ETFs. Global investors treat U.S. equities as the default ownership claim on global innovation, simply because of the sheer scale and the rule-based allocation.
So after looking at this massive interconnected global machine, you know, the venues, the automated indexes, the algorithms, the Fed DJing, the macro environment, what on earth are you, the listener, supposed to do with this information?
That's the big question.
Yeah, let's ground this macro analysis back to the micro. The institutional frameworks provide a beginner investor risk map that is actually highly revealing.
Yeah, it divides risks into quadrants based on the potential impact on your wealth versus your actual level of control.
Right. It aggressively contrasts high impact but low control risks, things like single stock concentration, options leverage, margin debt, and the absolute destroyer portfolios, panic selling.
The absolute destroyer.
Yeah, and it contrasts those against high impact but higher control risks. Those are the mechanics you can actually manage. Your asset allocation, maintaining emergency cash, tax awareness, and position sizing.
Exactly.
Let's dig into the emergency cash part, though. Why is an emergency fund considered a structural market advantage in this report rather than just, you know, basic personal finance advice?
Because the entire market infrastructure is designed to violently punish forced selling. The high-speed algorithms we discussed are constantly hunting for liquidity.
Hunting for liquidity?
Yes. If you use margin leverage to buy stocks and the market suddenly dips, the clearing systems automatically liquidate your position to protect the broker.
Wait, automatically?
Automatically, you don't get a choice. You are forced to sell at the exact worst possible price.
That's brutal.
So maintaining a cash buffer keeps you out of the algorithmic crosshairs. It ensures you only sell an asset when your time horizon dictates it, not when the machine forces you to.
This reveals some fascinating structural tensions in the modern market. We have this incredible democratization. You can buy fractional shares, execute zero commission trades, and buy ETFs that give you instant institutional exposure.
It's amazing access.
But alongside that, we have massive mathematical concentration in the indexes. We have unparalleled liquidity on normal days, but the speed of these algorithms creates deep fragility when everyone rushes for the exit at once.
Yeah, we have a culture of capital discipline that often morphs into dangerous short-termism, largely driven by quarterly earnings pressure. The speed of the machine often conflicts with the reality of actually building a business.
You know, reading through this structural breakdown, I couldn't help but notice the irony. We live in an era of unprecedented technological access. You can literally trade complex derivatives from your phone while waiting in line for a coffee.
Right.
Yet, after mapping out this phenomenally complex machine, the ultimate survival guide for the individual investor is shockingly simple. Define your time horizon. Use diversified low-cost funds as your core. Maintain emergency liquidity. And entirely avoid leverage unless you understand the downside mechanics perfectly.
Yep.
So, is the ultimate structural advantage in this high-speed algorithmic machine just patience?
Without a doubt. The foundational premise of structural investing is that your first job is not prediction. It is knowing exactly which risk you are taking.
Knowing your risk.
Right. Are you taking compensated market risk or are you taking uncompensated behavioral risk? A heavily concentrated portfolio of single stocks can build spectacular wealth, but it can also permanently destroy it.
Right.
The key takeaway from understanding this architecture is realizing that price movement, that daily red and green volatility flashing on your screen, is not the same thing as permanent loss.
Unless, as we just discussed, you are forced to sell.
Exactly. Forced selling, whether it's triggered mechanically by a margin call from using too much leverage or triggered emotionally by a panic attack, is the mechanism that turns standard market volatility into actual permanent financial damage.
Okay, let's bring this all together. The U.S. stock market isn't just an app on your phone. It isn't a chaotic casino. It is a three-layer machine.
Yes.
It is the intersection of institutional trust, enforceable law, dollar liquidity, and technological narrative. It's the infrastructure of global capitalism.
It allocates capital to innovators, it discovers the price of the future, and it anchors household wealth. Understanding the plumbing underneath completely changes how you view every single financial headline.
It really does. But before we wrap up, there is one final lingering thought from this structural analysis that we want to leave you with.
Oh, this is a good one.
We talked earlier about the U.S. market's ultimate superpower, this unique cultural ability to relentlessly convert narrative into valuation. For over two centuries, human beings, the brokers under the buttonwood tree, the Wall Street analysts, the media pundits, have been writing that narrative.
Right.
But as we move deeper into this new era, AI isn't just the leading sector driving the massive index weights. It is rapidly becoming the very tool scraping the data, writing the analyst reports, digesting the corporate earnings calls in real time, and executing the algorithmic trades.
Which represents a profound structural shift in how price discovery actually happens.
So the question is this: if the machine fundamentally runs on narrative, who or what will actually be creating the narrative of American capitalism a decade from now?
That is something to carefully consider the next time you log into your portfolio.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Next time you see that ticker tape flashing red and green, remember the invisible plumbing underneath.